Welcome back to the fourth session of chapter one of the reading and commentary on Simplicity Parenting by me, Kim John Payne. We are picking up this theme of cumulative stress reaction and just moving that a little further in today's reading and commentary. Let's just jump right into the text again. To look at our society's assault on childhood another way, let's take the sleep analogy. Most of us acknowledge the need for a good chunk of it, 7 to 8 hours nightly, yet many of us would love to be able to function well with significantly less. Some feel that they manage very well on 4 hours a night. Thomas Roth of the Henry Ford Sleep Disorder Center in Detroit would doubt that, however. Quote, "The percentage of the population who need less than 5 hours of sleep per night, rounded to a whole number," says Roth, "is zero." Another example is that of Robert Stickgold, a Harvard cognitive neuroscientist specializing in sleep research, recounted how a psychiatrist in private practice called to ask him whether he knew of any reason not to prescribe modafinil, a wakefulness-promoting drug, to an undergraduate during exam time. Steingold responded, no reason at all. Not unless you think sleep does something. End of quote. Does sleep do something besides mark the time between wakefulness? Does childhood do something other than mark the time until adulthood? We die without sleep. We should render the question moot. But scientists still argue over which process, which processes occur exclusively during sleep. Mental and emotional clarification, improvement of motor skills, a kind of mental practicing of movements take place as we sleep, and some feel sleep helps maintain homeostasis in the brain. The immune system doesn't work properly without sleep, and we know that a lack of sleep impairs speech, memory, innovative, flexible thinking. Rats deprived of sleep die in 17 to 20 days. Their hair falls out, and their metabolism kicks into high gear, burning lots of calories, while the rats are just standing still. Scientists are learning that the biological purpose of sleep, and they're learning this by studying what happens when we're deprived of it. Sleep-deprived people are much less able to retain or use what they learn while they're awake. They lose resiliency, mental and physical, and as their system, particularly their immune system, falters. Still, we wonder, can we skip it? Can we do without it? Or shortchange it in some ways to reclaim that third of our lives that is lost to slumber? As a society, we seem to be asking the same questions about childhood. What purpose does it serve? Can we speed it up? Can we better prepare our children for adulthood by treating them more like adults? I worry that we'll understand the purpose of childhood by seeing increasingly what people are like when they're rushed through theirs. And I don't think it'll be a pretty picture. Childhood has its own mysterious processes and its own pace. When we ask children to keep up with a speeded world, I believe we're consciously doing them harm. We're depriving them of exactly what they need to make their way in an increasingly complex world. Well-being and resiliency are affected. And yet I sincerely believe that there are many things we can do as parents to buffer and protect our children's childhood. Quite simply, a protected childhood allows for the slow development of identity, well-being, and resiliency. Again, quite simply, a protected childhood allows for the slow development of identity, well-being, and resiliency. I was giving a lecture recently and on my way heard a report about global warming. Now, James, that dear little fellow I described before, had taught me quite a bit about the subject. But I was thinking as I drove that when problems seem overwhelming, we often rush at them in a state of pure anxiety. Off we go, walking, to the hardware store for recycling bins or fluorescent light tubes, stopping first to look at hybrid cars, luckily on the way, while picking up trash and making a silent vow that from this day forward organic cotton will be the only fabric to ever touch our child's skin. Why must we do all of this and more immediately, if not sooner? To plug up that bloomin' hole in the ozone, of course. Yet our actions would be so much more consistent and ongoing with our motivation if our motivation was not anxiety, but compassion and a desire to protect the earth. This reminds me of a man who came to one of my lectures. This guy came under duress, I'm quite certain of that, at his wife's insistence. Well, he admitted it, actually. Afterwards, we happened to be standing next to each other, and he turned to me. "Well done," he said kindly about my talk, though I'm not sure he was awake through all of it. Food for thought, isn't it? I'm a Harvard man myself, and I doubt my Ben will be following my lead unless we get this attention stuff up to snuff. I'll make the simplification list right away. Good idea. His exams next year. Do you think that's enough time to get all this turned around? Now, this man was too well rested to be anxious, but the point is he missed the point. Actually, acting out of anxiety doesn't usually lead to long-term efforts or changes, much less large-scale transformation. The point of simplification is not to improve Ben's test scores much, as, you know, of course I wish the boy well. Ben's well-being is the goal. Imagine the motivation and inspiration we can bring to our efforts with the larger goal of protecting our beloved children's childhood. Childhood is also an all-important environment with its own systems, its own natural processes. And society is poking quite a few holes in the protective filter that should surround childhood to buffer it from adult life and concerns. A comment here, it's almost like we have the ozone layer with global warming, you know, thinning and developing holes that protect the ecosystem of our climate. But it's this very fast-paced life that is almost burning off the layers that protect childhood, creating holes so that the outer world can rush through and really affect our child's ecosystem, which we could call, another name for it, of course, is just childhood. So back into the text. The good news is that there are many things we can do as parents to protect the environment of childhood. There are many ways we can erect filters to stop the speed and the stress of adult life from pouring in unchecked into our kids' homes, heads, and hearts. As my work became increasingly focused on simplification, I saw how effective this process can be in restoring a child's sense of ease and well-being, in shifting a family's direction so that their daily life efforts are in concert, not in opposition with their dreams. Now, before we focus on each layer of simplification in the chapters ahead, I want to give you an overview of the process. With stories and examples from some families that I've worked with, I'll try to show you how simplification clears a space and clarifies a family's intention for their own unique path. I'll take you through through a consultation, asking you some of the questions I've asked other families to consider in order to act out of hope rather than fear, out of reverence for childhood rather than fear of our times. Simplification begins with dreams. Carl Sandburg once said, "Nothing happens unless you first dream." Now, this is no exception. Your dreams for your family life will be your motivation. They'll act as your wings throughout the process. So let's have a look at the process, hopes and dreams. Very often families would come to me, whether through a school or private practice setting, because of a child's behavioural issues. The impetus for a call or consultation is similar to a rash. It's usually just an outer sign of something else, a broader or deeper issue. As I mentioned in the introduction, you can see so much, including what a family holds dear, from the patterns of their daily lives. In order to get a clearer view of a family's issue, I used to offer them a choice between several months' worth of family therapy sessions or a one-day visit from me. Either way, I felt this would give me the same level of insight. Although it amused me and didn't surprise me how often families would initially choose months of sessions, Mum and Dad eyeing each other nervously rather than this, day's visit. Certainly, having someone invade your home for an entire day from wake-up time until after a child's bedtime is no one's idea of an inviting prospect. I don't think the observation days were as painful as parents might have imagined. I'd spend the day taking in the family's particular dance of daily activities. I might play with the children, help a bit with the dishes. I would often bring a little project with me, something I was making or mending, which would keep my focus from seeming too intense. While my presence was noticeable, I didn't sit there and stare, clipboard in hand, and stopwatch at the ready. Essentially, I tried to stay on the margins, but within the overall mix of daily life. I might also split my observations to cover part of a school day and part of a weekday, depending on the particular difficulties or stresses of the family. Imagine just such an average day for your family, and what it might look like to an observer. What are the difficulties that might arise? What are the periods of the day that are consistently stressful? A day or two after my home visit, I'd meet with the parents and we'd begin these post-visit meetings with an interesting, usually very moving discussion about family ideals. But by this, I do not mean the term co-opted by politicians to convey whatever they're promoting at the time. I mean a couple's own vision for their family, how they imagined it before they had children. It was important for them to dream their way back before stepping forward to reclaim their images and hopes most central and dear to them. These were the images that would guide them through the work ahead, and simplification would help enormously in recovering those dreams. Now, just a quick comment to round off our session today. These visits that I would make became for me such an insight into how family life had heated up. Do you remember that image we talked about the frog in the beaker? That image of it heating and heating and heating and getting faster and faster and faster, because when I would pause and sit with these very dear, I've got to say brave parents for allowing me into their home, it was very interesting when we would pause and talk about their ideals and their hopes And we would go back to the very early days of their parenting and what they really wanted to achieve with their family and what they hoped their family would be. There was such a stark comparison. It really stood out how far they'd come away from it without really knowing it. It had just crept up on them. And, you know, as you're listening to the reading of this book and to these comments, I'd invite you to do the same, if it feels right, is pause and think about those hopes and dreams that you had when your children were first born. Talk to your extended family, to your partner, if you have a partner at home, a co-parent, and talk to them and just recreate that a little bit. And then just have a look as objectively as you can about where you are and see if that's still vaguely matching up or if that's really a long, long, long way away from where you intended to be. And while that might seem a little depressing thing to suggest to do, I've seen it over the years as being highly motivating. At first it can be a little shocking perhaps to some people, but it can serve to motivate us if, and this is a big if, but if we've got a roadmap of how we can find our way forward. And that's exactly what we'll be describing and covering in the rest of these readings and in the commentaries. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you.